The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 3, Side 2.
And a whole gang sat there in that third section in the Jida camps of Buryat, Mongolia. Chief of the Security Operations Section Sokolov, Interrogator Mironenko, Security Officers Kalashnikov, Sosikov, Osintsev. We've fallen behind. Everyone else has plots, and we have fallen behind. We do have a major plot, of course, but what kind? Well, of course, the militarized guard is to be disarmed. Yes, of course. They're going abroad. After all, the border was close and Hitler was far away. With whom should they begin? And just as a well-fed pack of hounds tears a sick, skinny, and mangy rabbit to bits, so did this sky-blue pack hurl itself on the unfortunate Babich, former Arctic explorer, former hero, now a last legger covered with ulcers. It was he who, at the outset of the war, had nearly turned over the icebreaker Sudko to the Germans, so all the threads of the plot were obviously in his hands. It was his scurvy, racked, dying body that was to save their well-nourished ones. "Even if you are a bad Soviet citizen, we will still make you do as we wish. You will kiss our boots. You don't remember? We will remind you. You can't write? We'll help you. You want time to think? Into the punishment cell on 10.5 ounces. And here is what another security man told him. "I'm very sorry. Of course you will come to understand later on that it would have been sensible to do as we demand. But it will be too late when we can break you like a pencil between our fingers." Where do they get this imagery? Do they think it up themselves? Or is there a selection of such phrases in Czechist textbooks composed by some unknown poet? And here is the interrogation by Mironenko. Hardly had they brought Babich in than he was hit by the smell of tasty food. And Mironenko made him sit quite close to the steaming meat borscht and cutlets. And as though unaware of that borscht and those cutlets, or even that Babich could see them, he gently cited dozens of arguments to relieve his conscience and justify not only the possibility, but also the necessity of giving false testimony. He reminded Babich amiably, "When you were arrested the first time in freedom and tried to prove your innocence, you did not, after all, succeed, did you?" "No, you didn't succeed, because your fate had already been decided before your arrest. That's how it is now. That's how it is now. Well, well, eat the lunch. Go ahead, eat it before it gets cold. If you are not stupid, we will get along very well. You will always be well fed and provided for. Otherwise..." And Babich shuddered. Hunger for life had turned out to be stronger than the thirst for truth. And he began to write down everything dictated to him, and he slandered 24 people, of whom he knew only 4. And for the entire period of the interrogation he was fed, but never given enough, so that at the first sign of resistance they could lean on his hunger again. Reading the record of his life, written before his death, sends shivers down your spine. From what heights and into what depths can a brave man fall? Can all of us? And so it was that 24 people who knew nothing about anything were taken to be shot or to get new terms. And before the trial, Babich was sent off to a state farm as a sewage disposal worker, and then gave testimony at the trial, and then was given a new tenor, with his previous term erased. But he died in camp before completing his second term. What about the gang from the Jida third section? Well, will someone investigate that gang? Anyone? Our contemporaries? Our descendants? And you? You thought that in camp at least you could unburden your soul? That here you could at least complain aloud? "My sentence is too long, they fed me badly, I have too much work." Or you thought that here you could at least repeat what you got your term for. But if you say any of this aloud, you are done for. You are doomed to get a new tenor. True, once a new camp tenor begins, at least the first is erased, so that as it works out you serve not 20, but some 13 or 15 or the like, which will be more than you can survive. But you are sure you have been silent as a fish, and then you are grabbed anyway? Quite right. They couldn't help grabbing you no matter how you behaved. After all, they don't grab for something, but because. It's the same principle according to which they clip the wool off freedom, too. When the third section gang goes hunting, it picks a list of the most noticeable people in the camp. And that is the list they then dictate to Babbage. In camp, after all, it is even more difficult to hide. Everything is out in the open. And there is only one salvation for a person, to be a zero, a total zero, a zero from the very beginning. To stick you with a charge presents no problem. When the plots came to an end after 1943, the Germans began to retreat. A multitude of cases of propaganda appeared. Those godfathers still didn't want to go to the front. In the Burepolom camp, for example, the following selection was available. Hostile activity against the policy of the Soviet Communist Party and the Soviet government. And what it was, you can guess for yourself. Expression of defeatist fabrications. Expression of slanderous opinions about the material situation of the workers of the Soviet Union. Telling the truth was slander. Expression of a desire for the restoration of the capitalist system. Expression of a grudge against the Soviet government. This was particularly impudent. Who are you, you bastard, to nurse grudges? So you get a tenor, and you should have kept your mouth shut. A 70-year-old former Tsarist diplomat was charged with making the following propaganda. That the working class in the USSR lives badly, that Gorky was a bad writer. To say that they had gone too far in bringing these charges against him is out of the question. They always handed out sentences for Gorky. That's how he had set himself up. Skvortsov, for example, in Lokchimlag, near Ust-Vim, harvested 15 years, and among the charges against him was the following. He had unfavorably contrasted the proletarian poet Mayakovsky with a certain bourgeois poet. That's what it said in the formal charges against him, and it was enough to get him convicted. And from the minutes of the interrogation, we can establish who that certain bourgeois poet was. It was Pushkin. To get a sentence for Pushkin, that in truth was a rarity. After that, therefore, Martinson, who really did say in the tin shop that the USSR was one big camp, ought to have sung praise to God that he got off with a tenor. As ought those refusing to work who got a tenor instead of execution. It was such a pleasure to hand out second terms, and it lent such meaning to the lives of the security operations sections, that when the war was at an end, and it was no longer possible to believe either in plots or even defeatist moods, they began to paste on terms under non-political articles. In 1947, in the agricultural camp Dolinka, there were show trials in the compound every Sunday. They tried potato diggers for baking some potatoes in bonfires. They tried people for eating raw carrots and turnips in the fields. What would some nobleman's serfs have said if tried for something like that? And for all this, they handed out terms of 5 and 8 years under the recently issued great Decree of 4/6. One former kulak was already coming to the end of his tenor. He was in charge of the camp bull calf, and he couldn't any longer stand to see it starve. He fed this camp bull calf, not himself, with beets, and got 8 years for it. Of course, a socially friendly Zek would not have undertaken to feed the bull calf. And that is how in our country over decades, natural selection operated, deciding who would live and who would die. But it was not the number of years, not the empty and fantastic length of years, that made these second terms so awful, but how you got them, how you had to crawl through that iron pipe in the ice and snow to get them. It would seem that arrest would be a nothing for a camp inmate, for a person who had once been arrested from his warm domestic bed. What did it matter to be arrested again from an uncomfortable barracks with bare bunks? But it certainly did. In the barracks, the stove was warm and a full bread ration was given. But here came the jailer and jerked you by the foot at night. Gather up your things. Oh, how you didn't want to go. People, I love you. The camp interrogation prison. What kind of a prison will it be, and how can it possibly advance your confession if it isn't worse than your own camp? All these prisons are invariably cold. If they aren't cold enough, then they keep you in the cells in just your underwear. The famous Vorkuta number 30, a term borrowed by the Czechs from the Czechists, who called it that because of its telephone number, 30, a bored barracks beyond the Arctic Circle, was heated with coal dust when it was 40 degrees below zero outside, one wash tub full a day, and not because they lacked coal in Vorkuta, of course. And they tormented them with more than that. They didn't issue them matches. And for kindling, there was one little chip the size of a pencil. Incidentally, escapees who had been caught were kept in this number 30 stark naked. After 2 weeks, anyone who had survived was given summer clothes, but no padded jacket. And there were no mattresses and no blankets. Reader, try it. Just try to sleep like that for one night. In the barracks, it was approximately 40 above. And that was how the prisoners were kept throughout the several months of interrogation. Even before that, of course, they had been worn down by many years of hunger and by slave labor. And now it was much easier to finish them off. What did they feed them? As the third section instructed, in some places 11 1/4 ounces a day, and in some places 10 1/2 ounces, and in number 30, 7 ounces of bread, sticky as clay, a piece little bigger than a matchbox, and once a day a thin gruel. But you still wouldn't get warmed up right away, even if you signed everything, if you admitted everything, if you surrendered, and if you agreed to spend another 10 years in this dearly beloved archipelago. Until your trial, they moved you from number 30 to the Vorkuta interrogation tent, no less famous. This was a plain, ordinary tent, yes, and full of holes to boot. It had no floor. The floor was the Arctic earth. Inside it was 7 by 12 yards, and in the center was an iron barrel instead of a stove. There were single-decker lattice bunks on one level, and those next to the stove were always occupied by the thieves. The political plebeians had to sleep around the outside or on the ground. You would lie there and see the stars above you. And you would pray, "Oh, the sooner they try me, the better. The sooner they sentence me, the better." You awaited that trial as a deliverance. People will say, no person can live like that beyond the Arctic Circle unless he is fed chocolate and dressed in furs. But in our country, he can. Our Soviet man, our archipelago native, can. Arnold Rappaport spent many months like that. The provincial assizes kept delaying its journey from Narianmar. Or here, for your delectation, is one more interrogation prison, the penalty camp of Orotukan in the Kolyma, 315 miles from Magadan. It was the winter of 1937 to 1938, a wood and canvas settlement, in other words, tents with holes in them but overlaid with rough boards. The newly arrived prisoner transport, a bunch of new interrogation fodder, saw even before being led in through the door. Every tent in the settlement was surrounded with piles of frozen corpses on 3 out of 4 sides, except where the door was. And this was not to terrify. There was simply no way out of it. People died, and snow was 6 feet deep, and beneath it there was only permafrost. And then came the torment of waiting. You had to wait in the tents until you were transferred to the log prison for interrogation. But they had taken on too much and too many. They had herded in too many rabbits from the whole of the Kolyma, and the interrogators couldn't cope with them. And the majority of those brought here were simply destined to die without even getting to their first interrogation session. The tents were congested. There was no room to stretch out. You lay there on the bunks and on the floor, and you lay there for many weeks at a time. Do you really call that congestion? Responds the Serpentinka. Here they wait to be shot. True, only for several days at a time, but standing the whole time in a shed, so that when they give them a drink, that is, throw pieces of ice over their heads from the doorway, it is so crowded that it is impossible to stretch out a hand to catch the pieces, and instead you have to try to catch them with your mouth. There were no baths, nor any outdoor exercise periods in the fresh air. Bodies itched, everyone scratched frantically, and everyone kept on searching for lice in padded cotton breeches, padded jackets, shirts, underwear, shorts. But they searched without undressing because of the cold. The big, white, bloated lice reminded you of plump, suckling piglets. And when you crushed them, they splashed your face, and your nails were covered with itchor. Before lunch, the duty jailer would shout through the door, "Are there any stiffs?" "Yes. Whoever wants to earn a bread ration, drag them out." They were dragged out and placed on top of the pile of corpses, and no one bothered to ask the names of the dead. The bread rations were issued on the basis of the total count, and the ration was 10.5 ounces, and one bowl of gruel a day. And they would also issue humpbacked salmon, rejected by the sanitation inspector. It was very salty. You were very thirsty after it. But there was never any hot water, never. Just barrels of icy water. You had to drink many cups to quench your thirst. G.S.M. used to try to persuade his friends, "Turn down the humpbacked salmon. That's your only salvation. You spend all the calories you get from your bread on warming that icy water inside you." But people simply couldn't turn down a piece of free fish, so they kept on eating it and then drinking, and they trembled from inner cold. M himself didn't eat it, so it's he who now tells us about Orotukan. It was so congested in the barracks, yet it kept steadily thinning out. After a certain number of weeks, the survivors of the barracks were driven outside for a roll call. In the unaccustomed daylight, they saw one another, pale, their faces overgrown with stubble, beaded with nits, hard, dark blue lips, sunken eyes. They called the roll by file cards. The answers were barely audible. The cards, to which there was no response, were put aside. And that is how they established who was left there in the piles of corpses, avoiding interrogation. All who survived Orotukan say they would have preferred the gas chamber. The interrogation? It proceeded according to the plans of the interrogator, and those in whose cases it didn't are not about to tell us. As the security chief Komarov said, "All I need is your right hand to sign the testimony." Well, yes, there were torches, of course, homemade and primitive. They would crush a hand in the door, and it was all in that vein. Try it, reader. The court? Some sort of camp collegium. This was a permanent camp court subordinate to the provincial court, like the people's court in the district. Legality was triumphant, and there would be witnesses balked by the third section for a bowl of gruel. In Burepolom, the brigadiers often testified against their brigade members. The interrogator, a Chuvash named Krutikov, forced them to. "Otherwise I will remove you from your position as brigadier and send you to Pechora." And so a brigadier named Nikolai Ronjin from Gorky stepped forward to testify. "Yes, Bernstein said that Singer sewing machines were good and that Podolsk sewing machines were bad." Well, that was enough. Enough at least for the assizes of the Gorky Provincial Court. Chairman Bukonin and two local Komsomol girls, Zhukova and Korkina. 10 years. In Burepolom there was also a smith, Anton Vasilievich Baliberdin, local from Tonchayevo, who used to be a witness at all camp trials. Should you run into him, please shake his honest hand. Well, and then finally, there was one more prisoner transport to another camp, to make sure you didn't take it into your head to get even with the witnesses against you. This was a short transport, 4 hours or so on an open flat car on the narrow gauge railroad. And then it was into the hospital. And if you could still put one foot in front of the other, tomorrow, first thing in the morning, you'd be pushing a wheelbarrow. All hail the Czechist vigilance, which saved us from military defeat and saved the security officers from the front. Few were shot during the war, if we exclude the republics from which we retreated in haste. And for the most part, new terms were passed instead. What the Czechists needed was not the annihilation of these people, merely the disclosure of their crimes. The convicted could then labor, or they could die. This was a matter of economics. In 1938, there was an extreme impatience to shoot on the part of the higher-ups. They shot as many as they could in all the camps, but they shot the most in the Kolyma, the Garyanin executions, and in Vorkuta, the Kashketin executions. The Kashketin executions were tied up with the skin-grating name of the old brickyard. That was what the station of the narrow-gauge railroad 12 miles south of Vorkuta was called. After the victory of the Trotskyite hunger strike in March 1937, and the deception perpetrated on its participants, the Grigorovich Commission was sent from Moscow for investigation of the strikers. South of Ukhta, not far from the railroad bridge across the Ropcha River in the Taiga, a long stockade was set up, and a new isolator, Ukhtakar, was created. This is where the interrogation of the Trotskyites of the southern section of the trunk railroad line was conducted. And commission member Kashketin was sent to Vorkuta itself. Here he dragged the Trotskyites through the interrogation tent. They were flogged with whips. And without even insisting that they admit their guilt, he drew up his Kashketin lists. In the winter of 1937 to 1938, they began assembling at the old brickyard the Trotskyites and also the Detsisti, the democratic centralists, from various concentration points, from tents at the mouth of the Sir Yaga, from Kochmes, from Sivaya Maska, from Ukhtarka, some of them without any interrogation whatever. Several of the most prominent were taken to Moscow in connection with trials there. By April 1938, the rest of them at the old brickyard numbered 1,053 persons. In the tundra off to the side of the narrow gauge railroad stood a long old shed. They began to settle the strikers in it, and then, as additional groups arrived, they also set up next to it two tattered old tents, which had nothing to reinforce them, for 250 persons each. We can guess what the conditions were from what we know about Orotakan. In the middle of the 6-by-20-yard tent like that stood one gasoline drum in place of a stove, for which one pail of coal per day was allotted, and in addition the Zeks would throw their lice in to add a little to the heat. A thick layer of hoarfrost covered the inside of the canvas wall. There were not enough places on the bunks, and the Zeks took turns lying down and walking. They were given 10.5 ounces of bread a day and one bowl of gruel. Sometimes, though not every day, they were given a piece of codfish. There was no water, and they were given pieces of ice as part of the ration. It goes without saying, of course, that they were never able to wash themselves, and that there was no bath. Patches of scurvy appeared on their bodies. But what made this more oppressive than Orotukan was that they sicked on the Trotskyites, the camp stormtroopers, thieves, murderers included, who had been sentenced to death. They were instructed that these political bastards had to be squeezed, in return for which the thieves would get relaxation of their sentences. The thieves set to with a will to carry out instructions so pleasant and so completely to their taste. They were named monitors and assistant monitors. The nickname of one has been preserved, Morots, Frost. And they went around with clubs, beating up these former communists and mocking them in every way they knew, compelled them to carry them piggyback, grabbed their clothes, defecated in them, and burned them in the stove. In one tent the politicals hurled themselves on the thieves and tried to kill them, but the thieves raised an outcry, and the convoy opened fire from outside to protect the socially friendly elements. It was, above all, this humiliation by the thieves that broke the unity and will of the recent strikers. at the old brickyard in cold and tattered shelters, in the wretched, unwarming stove, the revolutionary gusts of 2 decades of cruelty and change burned themselves out. And the Russian tradition of political struggle also, it seems, lived out its last days. Nonetheless, thanks to the eternal human trait of clinging to hope, the prisoners in the old brickyard waited to be sent to some new project. For several months they had endured agonies there, and it was quite unbearable. And then, truly, early on the morning of April the 22nd, we are not fully certain of the date, but that, after all, was Lenin's birthday, they began to assemble a prisoner transport of 200 persons. Those summoned were given their bags, which they placed on sledges. The convoy guards led the column east into the tundra, where there was no dwelling nearby, though Salekhard lay in the distance. The thieves rode in back on the sledges with the things. Those who remained behind noticed only one unusual thing. Occasionally bags would fall off the sledges, but no one bothered to pick them up. The column marched along in good spirits. They were expecting some kind of new life, some kind of new activity, which, even if fatiguing, would be no worse than all that waiting. The sledges had fallen far behind. The convoy itself began to fall behind, no longer ahead or at their sides, but only at their rear. So what? This laxity of the convoy was a good sign. The sun shone. Then, all of a sudden, rapid machine gun fire began to descend on the black moving column of Zeks from invisible emplacements, from out of the blinding, snowy wastes. Some prisoners started to fall, while others still stood, no one understanding a thing. Death came in sunny and snowy garments, innocent, merciful. All this was a fantasy on the subject of the coming war. From snow-covered temporary emplacements, the murderers rose up in their Arctic cloaks, they say the majority of them were Georgians, and ran to the column and finished off with revolvers all those still alive. Not far off were the previously prepared pits to which the newly arrived thieves began to drag the corpses. To the chagrin of the thieves, the dead men's things were burned. On the 23rd and the 24th of April, another 760 persons were shot in the same place in the same way, and 93 were transported back to Vorkuta. These were the thieves, and evidently the Stuli provocateurs. The names of some of them were Reutmann, Isniuk, Model, an editor in Gozlidistad, Aliyev, and one of the thieves was called Tadik Nikolaevsky. We cannot say for sure precisely why each of them was spared, but it is hard to imagine any other cause. Such were the main Kashketin executions. I collected this information from 2 Zeks with whom I was imprisoned. One was there and had been spared. The other was a very inquisitive person who at that time was passionately determined to write the whole story, and who had been able to see these places by tracking down the warm trails and questioning whoever he could about it. But some transports of condemned Zaks arrived too late, and they continued to arrive with 5 to 10 people at a time. A detachment of killers would receive them at the old brickyard station and lead them to the old bathhouse, to a booth lined with 3 or 4 layers of blankets inside. There the condemned prisoners were ordered to undress in the snow and enter the bath naked. Inside, they were shot with pistols. In the course of 1.5 months, about 200 persons were destroyed in this way. The corpses were burned in the tundra. The old brickyard shed and Ukhtarka were burned down, and the bath was put onto a railroad flat car and taken to the 191st milepost of the narrow-gauge railroad and dumped. There it was found and studied by my friend. It was saturated with blood on the inside, and its walls were riddled with holes. But the executions of the Trotskyites did not end there. Some 30 or so others who had still not been shot were gradually assembled and then executed not far from number 30. But this time it was done by other people, and the first detachment of killers, those Chekists and convoy guards, and also those thieves who had participated in the Kashketin executions, were also shot soon afterward as witnesses. In 1938, Kashketin himself was awarded the Order of Lenin, for special services to the party and the government. And 1 year later, he was shot in Lefortovo. Nor could one say this was the first time this had happened in history. A. B. Blank V. has told how executions were carried out at Adak, a camp on the Pechora River. They would take the opposition members with their things out of the camp compound on a prisoner transport at night. And outside the camp compound stood the small house of the third section. The condemned men were taken into a room one at a time, and there the camp guards sprang on them. Their mouths were stuffed with something soft, and their arms were bound with cords behind their backs. Then they were led out into the courtyard, where harnessed carts were waiting. The bound prisoners were piled on the carts, from 5 to 7 at a time, and driven off to the Gorka, the camp cemetery. On arrival, they were tipped into big pits that had already been prepared, and buried alive. Not out of brutality, no. It had been ascertained that when dragging and lifting them, it was much easier to cope with living people than with corpses. This work went on for many nights at Adak, and that is how the moral political unity of our party was achieved. Chapter 14. Changing One's Fate. To defend yourself in that savage world was impossible. To go on strike was suicide. To go on hunger strikes was useless. And as for dying, there would always be time. So what was left for the prisoner? To break out. To go change one's fate. The Zeks also called escape the Green Prosecutor. It was the only popular prosecutor among them. Like all the other prosecutors, he too left many cases in their previous situation, or in an even worse situation than before. But sometimes he freed them outright. He was the Green Forest, he was the bushes and the greensward. Chekhov used to say that if a prisoner was not a philosopher who could get along equally well in all possible circumstances, or let us put it this way, who could retire into himself, then he could not but wish to escape, and he ought to wish to. He could not but wish to. That was the imperative of a free soul. True, the natives of the archipelago were far from being like that. They were much more submissive than that. But even among them there were always those who thought about escape, or were just about to. The continual escapes in one or another place, even those that did not succeed, were a true proof that the energy of the Zeks had not yet been lost. Here is a camp compound. It is well guarded. The fence is strong, and the inner cordon area is reliable, and the watchtowers are set out correctly. Every spot is open to view and open to fire. But all of a sudden you grow sick to death of the thought that you are condemned to die right here on this bit of fenced-off land. So why not try your luck? Why not burst out and change your fate? This impulse is particularly strong at the beginning of your term of imprisonment in the first year, and it is not even deliberate. In that first year when, generally speaking, the prisoner's entire future and whole prison personality are being decided. Later on, this impulse weakens somehow. There is no longer the conviction that it is more important for you to be out there, and all the threads binding you to the outer world weaken, and the cauterizing of the soul is transformed into decay, and the human being settles into camp harness. During all the years of the camps, there were evidently quite a few escapes. Here are some statistics accidentally come by. In the month of March 1930 alone, 1,328 persons escaped from imprisonment in the RSFSR. And how inaudible and soundless this was in our society. With the enormous development of the archipelago after 1937, particularly during the war years, when battle-fit infantrymen were rounded up and sent to the front, it became even more difficult to provide proper convoy, and not even the evil notion of self-guarding could solve all the problems of the chiefs. Simultaneously with that, there was the hankering to get from the camps as much economic profit and production and labour as possible, and this compelled, particularly in logging operations, the dispatch of work parties and sub-parties on distant assignments, and their extension into more remote areas. And the guards supposedly surrounding them became even more illusory, ever more unreal. By 1939, on some of the auxiliary expeditions of the Oost-Vim camp, instead of a perimeter fence surrounding the camp, there were only pole or wattle palings, and no nighttime illumination. In other words, at night no one kept the prisoners from departing. Even in the penalty camp in this camp complex, when the prisoners were taken into the forests for work, there was only one armed guard for a brigade of prisoners. It is obvious that he had no way to keep track of them, and 70 men escaped from there during the summer of 1939. One even escaped twice in one day, before lunch and after lunch. However, 60 returned, and there was no news of the rest. But that was in the wilderness. In Moscow itself, 3 very easy escapes took place while I was there, from the camp sector at Kaluga Gates during the day, when a young thief climbed the fence of the work compound, and with his thief's talent for braggadocio, sent the camp a postcard the next day, saying he was off to Sochi and sending his best wishes to the camp chief. From the Marfino mini-camp near the botanical gardens, the girl I have already written about. And from the same place, a young non-political offender jumped on a bus and went off to the centre of town. True, he had been left entirely without any guard at all. Ganged up on us, the MGB took a cavalier attitude toward the loss of a non-political offender. In all likelihood, they did some arithmetic in Gulag one bright day and became convinced that it was much cheaper to permit a certain percentage of ZEK losses than to establish a truly strict guard over all the many thousand points of imprisonment. And at the same time, they relied on certain invisible chains which kept the natives reliably in their place. The strongest of these chains was the prisoners' universal submission and total surrender to their situation as slaves. Almost to a man, both the 58s and the non-political offenders were hard-working family people, capable of manifesting valor only in lawful ways, on the orders of and the approval of the higher-ups. Even when they had been imprisoned for 5 and 10 years, they could not imagine that singly, or God forbid, collectively, they might rise up for their liberty, since they saw arrayed against them the state, their own state, the NKVD, the police, the guards, and the police dogs. And even if you were fortunate enough to escape unscathed, how could you live afterward on a false passport with a false name, when documents were checked at every intersection, when suspicious eyes followed passers-by from behind every gateway? And the universal mood in the corrective labor camps was, why are you standing there with your rifles? What are you watching us for? Even if you disperse, we'll make no move to go anywhere. We are not criminals. Why should we escape? And we are going to be freed in a year anyway. Amnesty. K. Strakovich relates that in 1942 his prisoner transport train was bombed while they were being taken to Uglich. The convoy scattered, and the Zeks stayed right there waiting for it to return. There are many such stories, like the story of the bookkeeper of the Ortowski division of Karlag. They sent him a distance of 25 miles with his financial report, accompanied by one convoy guard. And on the way back, he not only had to haul the dead-drunk convoy guard in a cart, but also to take particular care of his rifle so the poor fool wouldn't be tried for losing it. Another chain was the Death Factory, Camp Starvation. Although it was precisely this starvation that at times drove the despairing to wander through the Tiaga in the hope of finding more food than there was in camp, yet it was this starvation that also weakened them, so that they had no strength for a long flight, and because of it, it was impossible to save up a stock of food for the journey. And there was another chain, too, the threat of a new term. A political prisoner was given a new tenor for an escape attempt under that same Article 58, and gradually it proved best to give Article 58.14 counter-revolutionary sabotage. The thieves, it's true, were given Article 82, pure escape, and 2 years in all, but up to 1947 they got no more than 2 years for theft and also robbery. So these were of comparable magnitude. Furthermore, camp was their native home. In camp, they did not starve, they did not work. Their smartest move was not to escape, but to serve out their term, all the more so because they might always benefit from some special privileges or amnesties. Escape for a thief was merely the sport of a well-fed, healthy body, and an explosion of impatient greed, to get out and go on a spree, to rob, drink, rape, show off. The only serious escapes among them were by bandits and murderers with long terms. The thieves loved to lie about their non-existent escapes, or wildly embroider the ones they did carry out. They will tell you how India, the barracks of thieves, received the challenge banner for the best preparations for winter, for the substantial amount of earth piled around the barracks wall. And they will claim they were digging a tunnel at the same time, and taking the earth out right under the chief's eyes. Don't believe them. All India wouldn't escape, and they wouldn't want to dig very long, because they needed easier and quicker ways, and the chiefs weren't so stupid as not to see where they were getting the earth from. The thief, Korzinkin, with 10 convictions on his record, a commandant trusted by his chief, really did escape, well-dressed, and really did pass himself off as an assistant prosecutor. But he had to add to that story how he spent the night in the same hut as the commissioner for catching escapees. They really did exist. Stole his uniform, his gun, and even his dog one night, and from then on passed himself off as the commissioner. He is lying through his teeth about all this. In their fantasies and stories, the thieves always had to be more heroic than they really were. Another thing restraining the Zeks was not the compound, but the privilege of going without a convoy. The ones guarded the least, who enjoyed the small privilege of going to work and back without a bayonet at their backs, or once in a while dropping into the free settlement, highly prized their advantages. And after an escape, these were taken away. The geography of the archipelago was also a solid obstacle to escape attempts. Those endless expanses of snow or sandy desert, tundra, taiga. The Kolyma, even though it was not an island, was more bitter than any island. It was a piece torn off from the rest, and where could you escape to from the Kolyma? People undertook escapes from there only out of desperation. It is true that there was a time when the Yakuts were hospitable to the prisoners, and undertook to help them. 9 sons, and I will take you to Khabarovsk. They took them there, too, on their reindeer. But then escaped thieves began to plunder the Yakuts, and the Yakuts changed toward the fugitives and started to turn them in. The hostility of the surrounding population, encouraged by the authorities, became the principal hindrance to escapes. The authorities were not stingy about rewarding the captors. This was an additional form of political indoctrination. And the nationalities inhabiting the areas around Gulag gradually came to assume that the capture of a fugitive meant a holiday, enrichment, that it was like a good hunt or like finding a small gold nugget. The Tungus, the Komis, and the Kazakhs were paid off in flour and tea, and in densely settled areas the Trans-Volga people living near the Burepolom and Unja camps were paid for each captured fugitive at the rate of 2 poods, £72, of flour, 8 yards of cloth, and several pounds of herring. During the war years, there was no other way to get herring, and local inhabitants simply nicknamed the fugitives herrings. In the village of Shertska, for example, when any stranger appeared, the children would run along in a group shouting, "Mama, there's a herring coming!" And what about the geologists, those pioneers of the northern wastes, those brave, bearded, booted heroes, those Jack London bold hearts? A fugitive had little hope of help from our Soviet geologists, and it was better not to come near their bonfires. The Leningrad engineer, Abrosimov, arrested in the Promparty wave and sentenced to a tenor, escaped from the Nivagres camp in 1933. He wandered about in the Taiga for 21 days, and he was delighted to meet up with some geologists. But they took him off to a settlement and handed him over to the chairman of the local trade union organization. You can understand the geologists, too. After all, they were not alone, and they were afraid of being turned in by someone in their group. And what if the fugitive was really a criminal, a murderer, and would knife them in the night? A captured fugitive, if he was dead when taken, might be thrown near the camp mess hall to lie for several days with a rotting bullet wound, so the prisoners would value their thin gruel more highly. This book is continued on cassette 4. side 1.